hot out there. It's a dry heat, though. It's different. Day full of therapy yesterday. Rode a tractor practically all day. I mean, had three or four different implements I was using, and so, you know, changing, I got a little bit of a break. But, boy, I tell you, I was out there, and our tractor does not have a canopy on it. It was hot. But it was dry heat, and I wore no sunscreen. I had a dust screen on. But it was, so much fun. I enjoyed it. Just let me play in the dirt a little while. I'm like a grown-up kid. Welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. You are listening here for the next hour. We got a full show. Lots of things going on. We're going to talk to John Stillwell from the Upstate Chapter of Quality Deer Management Association. Make sure I got that right. Foothills Branch, I'm sorry. We're going to talk to Katie Zimmerman from the Coastal Conservation League. We're going to have probably a live report from Durant, Oklahoma, on the anglers from USC. There's two teams out there trying to qualify for the Bass Collegiate Championships, which will be happening, I believe, in July is when that's going to be, but I don't think they've told us when and where. And then just got a lot of other little things I'm going to try to fit in when I have time. Today is hot. It's probably the official first day of summer on the Woods and Water, South Carolina, because Chick-fil-A is back with peach milkshakes. Yes, Dave already drunk his. I'm starting on mine. I don't think there's any. The law of diminishing returns does not apply to Chick-fil-A peach milkshakes. I think, you know, everyone's just as good as the one before and just makes you want the next one as much. So if you're out there, I'm telling you, they're good. They're good. Don't pass by Chick-fil-A today without getting a chocolate milkshake. I mean, not a peach milkshake. Rode the tractor yesterday, but yesterday morning was looking into a clear cut, partial clear cut. And so imagine this, this green branches and trees and bushes and muscadine vines and all. And deer are just red this time of the year. They are, it's amazing how bad they stand out. But anyway, I could see a couple of does, and every once in a while you saw this. And this little spotted thing went through a gap in the trees, and then it came back the other way, and it was like puppies playing. I couldn't tell if there were two, three, or four fawns, but they were all just chasing each other around, and you couldn't see them for very long. You just catch little glimpses of them. It was so cool. And I say that because they are cute, and if you see one, it does look lost. We lost one to a coyote. We'd been seeing one pretty regularly behind my neighbor's house, and one of his dogs brought him evidence that fawn didn't make it. So if you're out there and you're a deer hunter, now's the time to go wail on some coyotes, actually the last couple months. I tried. Either my calling is not as good as it used to be, or they just weren't around where they could hear me. I didn't hear any. I didn't see any. But I did try to get out there. But when you see those fawns, and I know we talked about this once already this year, and I want to talk about it again because leave them alone. There was a woman who found a fawn and advertised it for sale on Craigslist. It's out of Sporting Classics Daily. Bizarre encounters between humans and wildlife are nothing new. When people taking selfies with bison, and I think somebody actually got nailed by another bison in Yellowstone the other day, and trying to pet elk, which are not pets at all, stealing a fawn seems a bit blasé. But that's just what a woman in California's Mendocino County did last week. Her efforts landed her in jail within 24 hours and provides yet another cautionary tale of why you should never handle wildlife. Leave them alone. She picked up a fawn around 2 a.m. She found it in good health, but rather than fearing for its survival, she picked the little deer up for a monetary gain. A Craigslist ad went up later that day and has since been taken down with a $300 price tag for the animal. Yikes. Law enforcement quickly took notice and set up a sting. Officials set up a meeting with David and her boyfriend, with the gate reporting that David thought she was doing what was right for the animal by selling it. She was arrested on the spot, not for the fawn's abduction. She had a warrant for failing to appear in an unrelated drug case, but could face a $1,000 fine and a year in jail for attempting to sell wildlife. I mean, the DNR had a picture up the other day of an officer riding around with a fawn in his front seat that somebody had tried to rescue. You know, they're not lost. If you find a fawn in the woods, leave it there. Its mother's not abandoning it. She's probably nearby. And you'll see them interact every once in a while like I did the other morning. But fawns, I mean, does stash fawns because the fawns don't smell. The does do. And the does lead the fawns because actually the fawns have a better chance of survival if they're not around other deer. And they're very well camouflaged when they're laying there in the sunlight and the shadows are across them. Charles Roos says, many people who come upon a solitary spotted fawn in the woods or along a roadway mistakenly assume the animal has been deserted by its mother and want to take the apparently helpless creature home to care for it. Young fawns like this have not been abandoned but are still in the care of the doe. The apparently helpless deer fawns born during April, May, and June in South Carolina begin daily movements with their mothers in about 3 or 4 weeks. Human handling and disturbance of fawns can cause a doe to shy away or even desert her offspring. Also, a bleeding response by the fawn can summon nearby predators. And they do. I heard one of those a week and a half ago. I had one fawn on the edge of a field, and I could hear one in the woods, in the woods on the edge of the field, bleeding. It's part of nature's plan for a doe deer to leave her fawn or fawns alone for the first few weeks of life. For the reason I stated, you know, the odor. It's all about the odor in wildlife. So if you run across a fawn, and they're everywhere. I know Joey Hudson here at the station had one in his backyard. So they're everywhere right now. Leave them alone. Please leave them alone. They're not abandoned. They're not lost. They're just fitting into nature exactly where they're supposed to be. Here's one that you don't... Just some news from DNR to fill up this first little bit here. Hundreds of thousands of striped bass were recently stocked by the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources in Lake Moultrie and Lake Greenwood. Now, Greenwood you don't think of normally as a striper fishery, but there are stripers there. 175,000 were put into Moultrie, and 40,000 were released into Greenwood, joining another 100,000 that were released there just 4 days earlier. Bunch of elected officials were there. Early spring's a busy period for the staff at the DNR. Jack Bayless Fish Hatchery in St. Stephens, where millions of striped bass and hybrid bass are produced for annual stocking efforts in lakes around the Palmetto State. And I've been there. It's a pretty cool facility. I've also been to the St. Stephens Fish Lift. You get a chance. It's closed now, but they open that up once a year when everything is migrating up. And Pam Holbrook, she's a biologist with DNR, actually goes in and harvests all the fish eggs, and it's a really neat thing. She's been on the program a couple of times. We'll have to get her back on next spring before it opens up. But 12 million fry will be produced at the facility this year, and those fish are stocked in the Santee Lakes, which are Moultrie and Marion, as well as Murray, Greenwood, Watery, and Thurman and Hartwell. And then, boy, striper fishing are making out like bandits this year. Because then you got about 1.2 million striped bass hybrids stocked by DNR in Lake Hartwell. 780,000 striped bass and 480,000 hybrids were stocked into Lake Hartwell on or about June 3rd. And they put them around at different places and all. It's funny, these fingerlings are only about an inch and a half to 2 inches long. And 2 to 3 years, they'll be ready to catch. Now, the reason we have such a prolific stocking facility is because, you know, stripers don't naturally reproduce in these upstate lakes because of the dams and all that keep them from going up the rivers. Geddes, Brandon. Geddes must be listening. They eat all my bass. Oh, get out of here. They're not your bass. They're everybody's bass. Anyway, so when you go out there and catch stripers in these upstate lakes and all, and some down in the lower part of the state, remember, it's all DNR putting them out there for us to catch. And I hope you will get out there and striper fish. They're fun to catch. They fight. Just a good fish, an easy fish for a kid to catch, mostly live bait. All right, hang on. When we come back, we're going to talk to John Stillwell with QDMA about QDMA and some of their upcoming events. We'll see you back here on Woods and Water. Searching for my lost shaker of salt. Woods and Waters, South Carolina. Geddes says those bass are his business partners. Just when you're a fisherman, you look at it that way. Yeah, okay. Geddes stopped by the house this morning. It was kind of fun to have him up in the upstate. He is actually up here volunteering for a South Carolina senatorial candidate, John White, Spartanburg, South Carolina. It's, you know, and I've never done politics on the show, so I'm going to stay away from that. But I would say this, be informed. You know, local elections have consequences, just like nationals. There are issues that, you know, don't apply here in South Carolina. We're kind of safe from. There are some that are very important to us. So, you know, primary Tuesday morning, Tuesday, I would hope you would take time to educate yourself, find a candidate that aligns with what you believe, and get out and vote. And I made my choice. I think it's a good one. But right now we've got on the line with us John Stillwell from Quality Deer Management Association. John, thanks for taking a little bit of time out of your Saturday and on vacation to call into Woods and Water.
No problem, Roger. Glad to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Anytime. You know, I was around in the late 80s when it started right here in Greenville, and it's been, although I lost contact with QDMA for more than a few years, it has really grown into an organization that has a voice and has a real impact, not only on current hunters, but those that are coming along behind us.
Well, that's what the mission of the organization is, Roger. I mean, a lot of folks probably don't know that it was an organization that started right here in South Carolina. You know, Joe Hamilton started the organization. It was called the South Carolina Quality Deer Management Association, and since that time, it's grown to, gosh, now over 60,000 members nationwide. Maybe over 70 now. I haven't checked lately, but it's really become a grassroots success story for sure.
Let me tell you, some of those first stickers were ugly. I think they were yellow and green. Those were some ugly QDMA stickers. I'm glad to see they've come a long way.
Yeah, luckily they've got some graphic designers who are a little more talented these days.
Right. You know, but back in the late 80s, two-color stickers were probably cutting edge.
That's about the best you can do, more than likely.
Well, John, you're a member of the Foothills Branch chapter. Tell us a little bit about QDM as a whole, if you can, and then more specifically about the Foothills chapter.
Sure. Really, I guess it probably makes sense to start off with just what the mission of the Quality Deer Management Association is.
Go right ahead.
And it's pretty simple. It's a one sentence statement. Is to ensure the future of white-tailed deer, wildlife habitat, and our hunting heritage. So it's just pretty straightforward and to the point. The whole purpose of our organization is to make sure that the white-tailed deer in North America, the habitat that they live in, and the hunting heritage that we have here in America is preserved and enhanced. So that's what QDMA is all about.
And it's a... I think more and more it's QDM practices. I think more and more are going to affect every state. I think with the recent legislation that we had here in South Carolina, it was a start.
I think what we've seen, especially over the past 20 years, is really even folks who aren't card carrying members of QDMA. In some form or fashion, a lot of their properties, their hunting leases, they've tried to implement at least some quality deer management practices on the places that they hunt. Yeah. You know, which is really a lot of people have a misconception about what QDM is. It's not trophy management. It's QDM is all about a balanced, you know, deer herd and with a, you know, that fits in the carrying capacity of the habitat that those deer are in. So it's not about just shooting does. It's not about all antlers. It's about a healthy herd and really at the basic level, protecting those yearling bucks to let them at least get get past that first hunting season and express their potential and provide a good rounded age structure in whitetail herds.
I think it's a great description. A healthy deer herd is what QDM is.
It really is. Especially these days, there's so many. There were folks who were for the legislation that just passed, and some that thought it didn't go far enough. But in the realities of how deer management works here in South Carolina, and how in the political system that we have, doing nothing wasn't an option that seemed like a good idea. And going as far as some folks, maybe myself included, as far as what the back limit was going to be for bucks and for antlers, maybe we didn't go far enough there either. But the reality is, you weren't going to get that far with this legislation. And so it was really about trying to find a good middle ground that made some improvements. And I think they did that with what just passed.
I think they did too. Well, tell us about the Foothills Branch. You know, how long has it been around? How many members? And what do y'all do during the year?
Absolutely. We started this branch. I mean, there was a previous branch in the Lyman area that had been active for several years. But I guess in the late 2000s, that branch kind of fizzled out. And in 2010, a gentleman named Everett McMillan kind of spearheaded the reestablishment of a branch in that Greenville area, and we put on an annual banquet every year since 2010. That's coming up. Our seventh one is coming up this August 25th. We'll have some more information out there about purchasing tickets for that. But it's always a good time. We've usually been in the past 2 or 3 years, we've been at about 350 people strong in our banquets.
Wow.
So they've been well attended.
Mm-hmm.
And really the rest of the year, that whole banquet, the whole thing that's designed to do is to drive what we do the rest of the year, which is, providing opportunities for youth hunters to get out there in the woods, providing opportunities for disabled, hunters to get in the woods. Putting on some educational events. We started a venison donation program that folks can take advantage of at Skinner's Deer Processing there in Fountain Inn area. So that's why we do what we do, is to be able to provide those opportunities educationally or hunting experience-wise for folks that may not otherwise be able to get that.
And that's something that's QDM as a whole. That's not just your branch saying we need to get kids and all that. That is heavily supported by the National Quality Deer Management Association. Is opportunity for all?
Oh, it's across the country. They, especially for kids. I mean, they do an amazing job. Something that's really grown. We haven't done as much of it here in South Carolina, but we should. There's some places that have done some really great military family hunts, youth hunts for kids. They set up pretty awesome hunts for kids whose parents are deployed overseas in the military. That's really exploded in QDMA circles and become a much bigger thing, which is great. They put on a national youth hunt every year down in Georgia, where they actually choose 10 kids to get to go down to a really, really nice plantation in Georgia. They get instructions on shooting for the Army marksmanship team and really just have a lifetime experience down there. So things like that are really what it's all about for the organization, as well as, obviously supporting whitetail research and habitat improvement and those kind of things.
That's great. You look at some of the places these first-time kid hunters and all get to go, and it's places I could never get invited to. I'm just not good-looking enough.
Oh,
I'm too old.
Yeah, that's right. And we've got them right here in South Carolina.
Yes.
One of the great things that we do the Lakeland branch in Greenwood, through a partnership with Plum Creek Timber, one of the largest private timber landowners in the country, they've got a 500-acre tract down in Greenwood County, and the only people who can hunt down there are kids, first-time hunters, wounded veterans, and somebody like you or me is not allowed to hunt on that property.
Out of luck on that one. That's the Puckett homestead, isn't it?
That's the Puckett Homestead. It's an awesome thing, and those folks down in Greenwood do a great job kind of spearheading that place.
Well, great. We got a couple minutes. Y'all have an event coming up here pretty shortly. I don't know if you're full or if you still could take more people in, but it's...
Oh, no, we're wide open. We'd love to have more folks.
Well, tell us.
We're having a... Go ahead.
Tell us about it.
Well, we're having we haven't had in the last couple of years, we hadn't had a field day, so we've partnered up with a couple different people. One of them is Ron Fleming with Wings and Antlers Wildlife Consulting Service. A lot of your folks may know Ron. He's retired from DNR and has a pretty successful wildlife consulting business here in the upstate. And he's going to be conducting a field tour of his farm in Pendleton this coming Saturday, a week from today. In Pendleton at the Cuffy Creek Farms. And it's free to anybody who's a TDMA member, free to kids 17 and under, and $10 for non-TDMA members. But if you'd like to come, the non-members, if you purchase a banquet ticket, which includes a TDMA membership, we'll let you in for free if you choose to do that. So we're going to provide a barbecue lunch and waters and tea and all that good stuff. The other big thing is we're doing this as a Father's Day field day because of the weekend that we're having it on, and we're partnering with South Carolina 4-H to have some activities for the kids.
Cool.
So they're going to be out there with a pellet trailer. They may have some animals out there for the kids to look at and touch and play with, and they'll also talk about their program that they have this fall, that's a partnership with QDMA, that's a food plot competition.
Yes. Yeah.
Where kids have the opportunity to plan a food plot, document what happens, the growth of the food plot, what animals come visit it. So it's a neat way to learn how to improve habitat for kids.
Well, if somebody wants to come to Foothills Branch Father's Day Field Day, they need to RSVP by June the 16th. Who do they contact about that?
They can send me an email to our branch account. The email address for that is foothillsqdma@gmail.com. And if they'll RSVP there, I can forward them some directions and more information on the day and make sure that we've got them down to join us this coming Saturday.
Great, John. I know Taylor and I are excited about coming out and being a part of this. Thanks for taking time on your Saturday to be on Woods and Water, and let's make this just the first time of many.
I'd be happy to come back anytime. Appreciate it. And y'all have a great weekend.
Thank you, John. You do the same.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Yeah, it's free. Barbecue lunch, $10 if you're not a QDMA. It would be a good opportunity for you to get involved. So hang on. We're going to talk to Katie Zimmerman from CCO when we come back after the break. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. It's a busy one, but it's a good one. And I often tell you, staying informed, being aware of what's, I always harp on my kids, you know, be aware of your surroundings. Things you care about, things you are concerned about, you need to stay up to date on what's going on, what the threats are, what some of the actions being taken are. And Coastal Conservation League is one of those things. I'm on a free email list. They're very well-written email updates. They don't spam you out with them. And we're privileged enough to have Katie Zimmerman, who works for Coastal Conservation League, on the phone. Katie, thanks for taking time on a Saturday to call me.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Coastal Conservation League, tell us just a little bit about what you are and what you do for them, and then there's a couple things we'd like to talk to in connection with what y'all do.
Sure. Yeah, the Conservation League we're an environmental advocacy group. We're with our main office in Charleston, but we work along the entire South Carolina coast. And then we also have an office in Columbia to make sure that we are involved and aware of what's going on with statewide legislation. And I direct the Air, Water, and Public Health Program. And I've been with the league for about 7.5 years now. And the projects that I primarily work on are, related to coastal regulations, wetlands protection, looking at various ways to make sure ocean health and wetland health are protected, and also looking at air quality issues. And that all is obviously important, not just because we want to protect our these natural surroundings, but that's our habitat. And so it's not just a feel-good issue. It also makes sure that we make sure humans are living and enjoying their surroundings as well.
You know, marshlands and wetlands are, wow, they're the nurseries of a lot of things a lot of people take for granted.
Yep.
You know,
sure.
red fishermen and shrimpers and, you know, most any other fish, crab, whatever, it starts out in those coastal wetland marshes where most people can't get to them anyway.
That's right.
And yep. They're hugely important. Yep. Like I said, I'm on your free email list. They're very well-written emails. I love getting them.
And, oh, thanks.
And I think you write a lot of the ones that I get, actually. So it's always nice to talk to the source.
Good. Yeah.
I guess the reason you're here today is Captain Sam Spitt. I mean, it's, and I think most of us listening today, and especially you and I, there are certain places you shouldn't build a house. I'm sorry.
Right.
There's just, I think common sense takes leave of us sometimes. We're like, gosh, this would be a beautiful place for a house, and it would be, as long as Mother Nature lets you have the house there. But right. Captain Sam Spitt, it's on the south end of Kiowa?
That's right, yep. It actually has a really, it's right on the tip of Kiowa, and then it also looks, if you're on Seabrook Island as well, you can see it very right. easily. It's right out in the middle of the water.
There's been an ongoing development down there. And just tell us a little bit of Captain Sam Spitt, because you got to have some background to know what's at stake and why y'all are fighting so hard on this. So give us some background on it, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. So Captain Sam Spitt, just like you mentioned, it's right on the southern end of Kiowa, and it's one of those places where it's not a barrier island, but it's a spit of land, and it's incredibly active, erosional piece of property that, it's got the Kiowa River along the backside of it, and then the ocean surrounding the remainder of it, and it's really only connected to the rest of Kiowa Island by a very thin neck of sand.
Yes.
And that neck of sand actually overwashes about every 40 to 60 years based on the data that we have, the existing data,
okay.
As far back as mapping went.
Okay.
So it's a piece of land that is doing exactly what Mother Nature designed it to do, and that is to accrete up on one side and then erode on another, and it acts as a wave barrier. It acts as amazing habitat for a lot of different species. Several of those species are actually now considered threatened.
Okay.
It's the remaining, one of the few remaining habitat areas for diamondback terrapins. There are right now, there's a bobcat den on the spit nearby Beachwalker County Park, which is a public area that's immediately adjacent to it. We've also got bottlenose dolphins that, while it's not a threatened species, certainly what bottlenose dolphins tend to do on the spit is unusual.
Yes.
And, that's called strand cheating. And it's a really odd thing if not a lot of people have been able to witness this in person, but if they really need to make sure that their food source, if they're running low on their ability to hunt, and they have this small amount of food source, the dolphin pod will basically thrash around so that they herd the fish up onto the beach,
right,
and then they throw themselves onto the beach after these fish and feed. And it's bizarre looking, and it takes a lot of energy from the dolphins to do this, so it's why it's an unusual thing to see them do.
Yeah.
And we've also got several threatened species of birds that rely on the spits and the very few beach areas that they have left to... it's a spot for them to rest during their very lengthy migrations to South America and beyond. Some of the birds go as far as Antarctica. And birds, you know, they're all about conserving energy.
Right.
So when they need a spot to rest, and humans have built up all their areas that are traditionally safe for them to rest, then these birds become threatened. And yeah. Captain Sam's Spit is one of those last remaining areas that exists for them to be able to rest up and feed up for their long journeys.
And we talked a little bit about and anybody can see this. I mean, anybody that lives away from the coast and goes to the coast once, twice, three times a year, they'll take a look at an inlet and go, that looked a little different last year.
Yeah.
You know, it's... And you have a storm coming through like the Outer Banks. You know, it cut a whole new inlet through the Outer Banks the last couple of years.
That's
so
right. That's
what we're talking about here. And the development was there. They wanted to put in a – well, go ahead and tell us. They want to put in a road across
that little spit. They do. Yeah. They – Kiowa Development Partners, who ended up buying Kiowa Island from – basically, the Kuwaitis had originally come in, owned, not originally, obviously, not
right.
when, obviously, Native Americans
yeah.
were there first, but
first
from what we're
trade
talking
money
about,
for
exactly, so the Kuwaitis actually owned Kiowa Island and had sort of planned some development out there, and originally intended with their development plan to never develop Captain Sam's Spit for all the reasons we're talking about. I mean, if you even just seeing photos of the spit, it's not a smart place to build because
no.
it is highly erosional, and it's a teardrop shape too. So it's, you know, you've got the end of the island sort of a drumstick that erodes and accretes. But they set that area aside as what they recommended should be green space, and then Kiowa Development Partners purchased the property, and they sort of left it alone as well until about 2005, and then through some trade-offs with the rest of the way they were designing Kiowa Island, they decided they were going to develop the spit and put 50 homes on it and an access road to get to those homes. They also wanted to do a community dock and some other amenities out there. So when we heard about it, we got involved basically a couple of years after that, the league. And the main point of contention was that Kiowa Development Partners was applying for permits to put in erosion control devices to protect the road that they wanted to build. The road, basically, as you said, goes along the neck of the spit leading from the rest of Kiowa Island. And because this is such a highly erosional area, they've got to do something if they want to prevent that road from being immediately overwashed. So they went in about 2008, 2007, somewhere around there, applied to the Department of Health and Environmental Control, and they were trying to get both a pretty long revetment wall and then also a vertical bulkhead. And both of those things would... not only, in their minds, prevent erosion to protect the road, at least for the short term, but it would also encroach upon the adjacent Beachwalker County Park, the parking lot for that. So that's, you know, public space and public use. So we got involved because, obviously, we feel that this is an inappropriate place to develop, and certainly... we don't want any sort of erosion control device going in that would impede the public's use and enjoyment of their spaces that our
right.
tax dollars are going to. And at the time as well, this was coming on the heels of legislation that had been introduced to Congress that would have removed the federal protections from cap and sam spits.
Okay.
So the spit sits within the Coastal Barrier Resources System, which is a federally designated area, which prohibits these areas from being covered by any sort of federally subsidized insurance because it is such an inappropriate place to build anything. And so there was some legislation introduced to get the spit removed from that system so that they could be covered by the taxpayers, basically, to build whatever they needed to. We fought that, and that was when Kiwa Development Partners went for their first set of permits to control erosion instead. So it's really the center of the controversy up until the legislation this session has centered around these erosion control devices.
Right.
And we've spent years and years and years in court fighting, appealing these permit applications. And there's been some unusual back and forth with this. You know, we went to it's actually been pretty unprecedented.
Yes.
The state Supreme Court actually heard one of our cases three different times, which is incredibly unusual. And they ended up, the result from the Supreme Court was they ruled that the erosion control devices were inappropriate, should not be allowed to go in, but they sent the case back to the administrative law court to make sure that any other things that the developer needed considered were taken into account. So things that had been stayed up until that point, until the resolution of our appeals, such as the community dock they wanted to put in, that was stayed while we sorted out the erosion control devices. So that was all sent back to this administrative law judge who recently ruled, he decided that he felt he was going to change the opinion, and he ruled that these erosion control devices, he thinks, are legal and for the public benefit because they will be partially protecting the parking lot at the public park next door.
Okay.
So we've been back and forth in court, and we're still continuing that. We've appealed that. The developer also, while we were appealing these erosion control permits, then applied for another one, a large sheet pile wall that would go on the riverside of the property. And so we've been in the midst of appealing that one as well. It's sort of never ending at this point.
We've got a couple of minutes. Tell us, all this has resulted in kind of a state law, or what we hope will be a state law, with the beach setback. Tell us, take about a minute and tell us about that.
Sure. And actually, it originally, the Cap and Sam spit specifically was not really part of our work on this beachfront management law.
Okay.
South Carolina in the late 80s passed a beachfront management act that was at the time the most progressive one in the country, arguably. Unfortunately, as development has proliferated in our state, you know, we're pretty popular.
Right, we are.
So we've seen a lot of development along our coast. And the state Department of Health and Environmental Control realized that there were some gaps in the beachfront laws that needed to be reviewed. So in 2007, they convened an advisory committee who pulled together all the research and sort of pinpointed exactly what the gaps were and maybe made a few suggestions, but not too many. It was mostly research-based.
Okay.
And then a Blue Ribbon Committee was convened, and that consisted of legislators, developers, conservationists, geologists, and attorneys. And they sat down and really hashed out recommendations to update the laws. So what was amazing about that was that by the time they completed their work in 2013, this incredibly diverse group of folks had agreed pretty much on even the most controversial changes to the laws. So that was very exciting, I think, for everybody. The most important of those recommendations was we no longer should be moving our beachfront baseline around.
Okay.
So until that point, DHEC had been about every 8 to 10 years going out and remeasuring from the dunes, setting that line all up and down our coast beyond which most development could not occur.
Okay.
But in areas that were accreting sand, even when we were renourishing beaches,
right.
So it wasn't natural accretion,
right.
Then the line was being redrawn. So we were placing homes in incredibly dangerous areas.
Okay.
And we've seen up and down the coast how that's placed out.
We have.
So,
about 30 seconds.
The law basically says that line can't be moved seaward ever again. And we got into a bit of a legislative argument because Kiowa Development Partners came in and began fighting the law for their own benefit, to the detriment of the entire coast.
So what do we think is going to happen? Do we think we're going to have a law that says this line is going to stay?
We do.
Yep.
Okay. We do. The governor officially signed it into law last week. And so basically DHEC goes out one more time, does one more delineation, and it's set. And so we'll see what happens if Kiowa Development Partners decides to appeal that line drawing.
Okay.
But it was great because our legislators recognized this is a serious issue, and there was the only contention was a couple of legislators who decided to help out Kiowa Development Partners in their arguments.
Cool. Well, thanks for that. It was very informative. You got some other stuff that y'all do. I'd love to get you back on to talk about some of the other stuff, too.
That's great. Thank you. I would love to. Thanks so much for having me to talk about this.
Thank you. And like I said, folks, it pays you to be informed. Katie, thanks very much, and we'll have you back on again.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Hang on. We got a live report from Durant, Oklahoma, from Todd Walters. Back on the other side of the break. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. A lot of good information today. But we got a call on the phone right now from Todd Walters. He is a co-fisherman on the... Are you on the Costa side? You're fishing the Costa series, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And Todd's son, Patrick, is a FLW collegiate champion. And y'all are out in Durant at Bass Fest. Well, that's the elite series, guys. But y'all are out in another lake. And you got two University of South Carolina teams trying to qualify for the Bass National Championships. How are they doing?
Roger, they've been doing good all week. They've been consistent. Like I said, we're Bass Fest right now, and the lake they're fishing is Lake Murray. It's about an hour west of where we're at for Bass Fest, and they're on the way here now.
Okay.
Expecting them probably within about 15 or 20 minutes.
Any idea how they did today?
I'm going to go with a track record of consistent.
Okay.
Because that's usually what we try and go for is just to be consistent when we're fishing 2 and 3 day tournaments.
Yeah.
And consistency usually pays off. But hoping we're doing a little bit better than what we did yesterday, trying to get inside that top 12 cut. And but like I say, the two teams, Chris Blanchett and Dylan, and Patrick and Brian, they've been catching fish all week. They feel pretty confident. And like I said, we're just looking for a good turnout here. Like I said, we're kind of out in no man's land out here. There's a team from Auburn, and we've maybe Mississippi State and Texas A&M, but pretty much a lot of Midwest teams out here. So none of the local teams we're usually fishing against.
Okay. New friends.
but the lake is absolutely gorgeous. It's 6,500 acres, clear water, grass. I think a lot of the fish that they were catching pre-fishing, you could pretty much see the fish
throw
the bait, and the fish would kind of come over and just attack it. I mean, you could shake him off, and he'd come back get it again. But I think a week of pre-fishing with 80 teams toward the end, those fish kind of got beat up a little bit.
Now, going into today, let's see, Chris and those were, what, in 11th, and then Patrick and his guy were in 16th?
Correct.
That's right.
Yep.
And they got to make, what, inside the top 12 goes on?
Got to be inside the top 12.
Do we know where the Bass is going to hold that championship or win yet?
Yes, it's going to be next month. And it's in Kentucky. It's a group called Green Lake, and it's in Kentucky.
Okay.
and it's about 6 weeks away.
Okay. All right.
So we've already got one team qualified.
Right.
So Will and Ethan already qualified for it, but like I said, we like to go in numbers, you know.
Yeah, you do. Well, there's strength in numbers.
That's it.
The trouble is, y'all make it tough on you. Make it tough on me from my side because I don't know who to go after. I need like two or three clones because I can't have a camera on all three teams like I did back on Lake Murray when I only had one team to follow around.
Well, that's just how the team is progressing. That, like I say, we're getting better and better every year. And like I say, instead of showing up with one team at these events, now we show up with two or three teams and at the main tournament. So we're getting some teams qualified. And when we go to these regionals, instead of showing up with one or two teams, now we show up with six or seven teams.
Yep. It's a great one. And these kids are good kids, Todd. You know, I mean,
exactly.
I can speak for Patrick and Geddes and Chris and Hampton and those, and you probably know more of that because you do a lot to support the team. I mean, obviously you're out there now, but I mean, your business supports things at USC and I tell you, you and I have a pretty good time when we get around each other too. You were good enough to ride me around at Winya Bay and watch Britt Myers on Saturday. I appreciate that. But, you know, what's it like? Got a minute or so. What's it like to have a son who's a FLW collegiate champion and actually fishing pretty good on his own right now too?
It is. It's awesome. We played football. We played baseball. I'd never get nervous like I do before to weigh in. So when I'm sitting trying to kill time while he's out fishing, it kills me. If I'm in the boat with him and we're fishing a tournament, I have no problem with
sure.
It's just not knowing.
Yeah.
And waiting on the weigh-in. If you go to a baseball game, a football game, you can see it as it progresses.
Right.
This fishing stuff is you don't know anything until it's over with and they show up.
That's it. Well, look, Todd.
How about Casey?
Do what now?
Man, how about Casey Ashley?
Yeah, you talk to him. Is he still, on TV, on Bassmaster Live, he looked real calm, cool, and collected. You saw him today. Is he still pretty loose and ready for tomorrow?
Yeah, he is still loose. He's still confident. He feels good about what he's doing. He's thinking that his fish are going to really show up for him tomorrow. The water's kind of drawing down. And they dumped a lot of water out. And I think his bite may be coming to him.
Well, he was talking the other day on TV that as they draw the water down, the fish that are way up high are going to pull out in the deep, and the fish that are deep are going to go up because the bait's going to get squeezed in these little transition zones.
Yeah, and hey, we know from looking at Casey at Hartwell, if he gets dialed in on them, he can put the hurt on them.
And he's been pretty dialed in. Well, look. Todd, I appreciate you calling in, giving us a live report. Best of luck to the guys. I'm sure I'll get updates as the weigh-in goes on.
Hey, that sounds good. Thank you for having me, Roger.
All right, Todd, take care of yourself.
You too.
All right. Yeah, it is. USC, they're not just taking one team to these things. They're really becoming a college bass fishing powerhouse, and it's been fun to watch. Been fun to watch, getting to know these kids. They keep me young. I have a fun time around them. Hope you enjoy it. And get behind a team. You know, find a college team and get behind them. It's a great sport. And there's another one. Hey, June 15th is the last day for public alligator hunting. Get those applications in. You know, find some back roads to travel. Make some time to get outside. Don't forget that camera. I'll be back here next Saturday, Father's Day, Woods and Water, South Carolina.